Welcome, everyone, and welcome to Making Climate Change History. This is a podcast where we interview people that have done just that. Joining us today is Nicole Stott. Nicole is an ex-NASA astronaut, having completed 2 space flights and spent over 100 days in space. Prior to becoming an astronaut, she was also a NASA engineer for over 20 years. She has since published an amazing book called Back to Earth: What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It. And additionally, she is also a co-founder of the Space for Art Foundation, which brings together children all across the world through the wonders of space exploration and art. We are so lucky to have you join us, Nicole. Welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So, Nicole, I absolutely loved your book, Back to Earth. I read it months ago. It was great. And I specifically enjoyed your emotional recounting of your Earthrise moment. We've all seen, you know, the Earthrise picture, but really reading your account of seeing your own Earthrise moment was really special to me. So thank you very much for sharing that. But are you able to describe, I guess, your journey from Earth to space to our listeners, and how that kind of happened for you? I know that's a bit of a big one, but, you know, how did it happen?
Well, I mean, I think just like what we're, you know, the conversation we're having today, I think it's inspired in some way, you know, and that inspiration can come from, you know, good experiences in your life, or things are going on around you that you want to see changed, and that kind of thing. I think for me, the pathway to space really started with parents who shared what they loved with me. I was inspired by the things that they shared. In particular, my dad built and flew small airplanes. I wanted to know how things fly. I wanted to experience that. And then later in life, when I was working as a NASA engineer, I discovered really what astronauts do. And, you know, more than the adventure side of launching in space, which I highly recommend. I mean, all of that is fantastic. But the fact that it became clear to me that, first of all, 99.9% of an astronaut's job is here on Earth, which, and most of it was a lot like what I was already doing as a NASA engineer, that encouraged me to think, oh, maybe this isn't just something that other special people can do. Maybe I can try this too. But I think above it all was the fact that it became really clear to me that all the work we're doing in space is ultimately about improving life on Earth. And I thought, oh my gosh, to be in that extraordinary place and to be able to participate in something like that just seems so, I mean, like there was such purpose in it, right? Beyond what I was doing to help get spaceships ready to fly. And as an engineer getting spaceships ready to fly, I felt like being in that place in space would be extraordinary as far as a path forward. And was fortunate to fly twice on the International Space Station, absolute masterpiece in space, this machine that, you know, we build to mimic what Earth does for us naturally. And I mean, best example of living off the grid you can find. I'll use that in terms of the kind of conversation we're going to have today. Yeah, there's, you know, it is direct from the sun. But really, really pleased to have had that experience and to be able to bring it back to Earth.
Yeah, I mean, incredible. There's so few people that have that experience, right? You're a handful of people that have traveled to space. And so when you were sitting, this is mainly, I'm just curious, and hopefully our listeners are too. So when you were sitting in that, I think sitting, right, in that spaceship, about to take off, do you remember what you were thinking? Like, did you have something going through your head? Did you have a mantra? Like, how does that happen before you take off to space?
Yeah, I mean, you get out there a couple hours before launch and, you know, imagine your airplane on the runway is rotated vertical. So you're in your seat, but you're laying on your back, you know, and, you know, out there for a few hours and you get comfortable. You're anxious, I think, to know what it's finally going to feel like. I mean, you cannot believe you're there. I mean, and I speak for my crewmates too. I think it's the same kind of general feelings going through you that, oh my gosh, how am I really and truly going to go do this today, you know, after training for so long. And so you get comfy and then that launch countdown starts. But in that whole time, I remember really feeling at ease, like, you know, I'd trained to do this. I felt like I understood the risks associated with it. And there are a lot of them. And I felt like we had trained in a way as a crew to not just live and work and survive and thrive well in space, but to deal with something that might come up if we were launching anything humanly possible that could be dealt with. I felt like we could do it. So I wasn't worried about us, but I was worried about, I mean, I remember just laying there kind of trying to chill about what my family must be feeling as they watched me strap into this rocket that's going to have, you know, 7 million pounds of exploding rocket stuff underneath it to get me out of the hold of the planet. So, you know, my 7-year-old son, my husband, my mom, my sisters, you know, my friends, that's what I was trying to kind of calm in my mind, was what they were going to experience in all this. And
absolutely,
I think in hindsight, they would say that they really enjoyed it in the moment. I don't know that they would.
Now that it was fine.
Oh, it was great.
I'm sure.
We're proud. We're thrilled.
Wow. Wow. I mean, what an experience. And so then when you took off and the countdown happened and then all of that, and then when you arrived at the International Space Station, at what point, I mean, did you realize or did you come to believe that you were in space? Was it a bit like, oh, there was a moment when you're like, oh yeah, like I'm so far from Earth right now. Like, how did that happen?
Well, I think it kind of starts on the launch pad, right? You know, you're sitting there so peacefully, quietly, I mean, really relaxed on the pad. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this explosion is happening under you. I mean, the dynamics change. The extremes of it are pretty impressive. Quiet, gentle to boom, was I ever on a launch pad kind of thing. And you know, rocketing off to space. And you get there. And again, it's this extreme. You know, you go from all that shaking and load on your body and energy. And in 8.5 minutes, you've accelerated from zero sitting on the pad to 17,500 miles an hour, about 5 miles a second, orbiting the planet. I mean, it's just it's a little bit mind-boggling, right? And you get to that place, and again, you are in this liberating, free, like I'd never imagined, you know, my body floating feeling. And my first thoughts, really, it's kind of like what you said. My first thoughts were, holy moly, we made it. You know, we got here safely, right? We're in this place in space. And I could not wait to get out of my seat and float to the window and, you know, experience Earth from that vantage point. And it's a really powerful thing from the very first sight of it, you know, and now you're floating, you're experiencing something that your body's never really felt before. And on top of that, this view of our planetary home out the window, it never stops impressing you. It is beyond any level of beauty, except for maybe in my son's eyes that I, you know, have experienced before. And I think you got to, you know, you got to figure out how to carry that with you afterwards as well.
I mean, what an, I mean, incredible. And so tell us about this, you know, this Earthrise moment and what Earthrise, you describe it so well in your book, and I'm just trying to like tease it out of you now, but you know, like what was that and just seeing Earth from space from the first time and what did that make you realize, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, like all of my colleagues, we speak to our other colleagues who have flown in space before us and try to understand, you know, what they felt, what they experienced beyond just the, how do you do the work up there and what, you know, the technical stuff. You try to understand, I think, the kind of the humanity of it, the human experience. And I think in hindsight, what I realize is that no picture or video really expresses that completely for us, right? Except for maybe one. And that was one that was taken. We're all familiar with it. You know, the over 50 years ago, I hope everyone is familiar with it, right? It was life-changing on a planetary level, really, you know, for humanity to experience this image, you know, back in, that was taken back in 1968 by the Apollo 8 group of, you know, this first time humans like actually saw with their own eyes Earth rising above the horizon of another planetary body, above the moon. I mean, I get goosebumps, you know, thinking about it now. And it was, and it is still like the best presentation of who and where we all are in space, right? And immediately you start thinking, at least I do, like, wow, that's our home. That's our spaceship. We're all in space. You know, you can't deny it when you look at that. And I mean, it just galvanized so much for us. It was a visual, stimulating driver for Earth Day, for the forming of our Environmental Protection Agency, all of these things that, you know, there was so much turmoil going on in that time too. And yet that one picture united us in a way that I don't know what else ever has. And so that's the kind of thing you try to bring back. You experience that yourself when you're in space. I think we all can experience it from right here on the planet by just opening ourselves up to the awe and wonder that surrounds us every day and appreciating how those things are wonderful in a way that keep us alive, allow us to survive here. And I guess in the simplest, without, I mean, I ramble on this one because it's so exciting to me that that perspective can be so powerful and mean so much to us, right? Because it's a connection to us. It allows us to see who and where we all are together. And so, I don't know, in the simplest way, and I share it in the book, it's like, man, we live on a planet. You know, you look out the window and you're like, wow,
my
kindergarten teacher was right, right? You know, we all know that, right? We live on a planet and it just continues to become deeper. It becomes like, and then it's like, you know, we're all earthlings. It's just so visceral right there. Only border that matters, that thin blue line of atmosphere, right? That's blanketing and protecting us all. And after living on this machine in space that we've built to mimic as best we can what Earth does for us naturally, you start to, I mean, you just start to realize like, wow, that thin blue line of atmosphere, that's what I think about when I'm trying to check and make sure the integrity of my thin metal hull is in good shape, protecting me from that deadly vacuum of space. That's why every morning I wake up and I'm like on a spaceship and I'm like, okay, how much CO2 is in my atmosphere? How much clean drinking water do I have? You know, that thin metal hull, is it still there? And absolutely the health and well-being of all those people that I'm there with, right? And it's such a perfect parallel for how we should be behaving down here on Earth. We need to accept our role as crewmates and not passengers here on Spaceship Earth. And that's what I'm hopeful that Earthrise, you know, does for everyone. You know, this reality of we have a role here to play in maintaining our planetary spaceship.
Yeah, I mean, that resonates so much. We're, as you say, you know, we're all crewmates. We cannot just be passengers, and we all have an individual responsibility to care for our environment on a small scale and on a planetary scale.
Yeah.
And some of my favorite,
I mean, not to interrupt you, but I think it goes beyond the beauty of the Earthrise moment, right? I mean, I think the thing that stuns you is the beauty of the planet.
Yeah.
In that, and the reminder of where it is and who we are. But it starts to become it's a very compelling thing to consider, you know, that we live on a planet in space together. And that is a beautiful place that we can create a future that is that beautiful by behaving like crewmates. And so it's every little thing that matters, and it's every big thing that matters in making sure that happens.
Yeah, so interesting. Some of my favorite quotes, and I'll share them with our listeners now that you've put in your book. And one of them is, you know, from that time, from the first Earthrise moment, Earthrise picture, I should say. So, you know, they said, "We came all this way to discover the moon. And the most important thing is that we discovered the Earth." And that really resonates. You know, it's true. We really take that step back and, you know, you see the trees from the forest and you're able to see the Earth from space. And as you said, you know, like, wow, that's it. Like, that's our planet. That's our entire life. And we need to protect that thin blue line, which, yeah, I think is amazing. So going back to your book then, obviously you've taken that learning and that experience and you very eloquently put it in your book. And you talk about the 7 ways of being to save our planet. And I really like that because I think of people from what I see in our work, you know, most people actually do care about the planet and they want to do something.
Yeah.
And they care and they find it beautiful and they want to preserve it for themselves, for future generations. And often it feels very overwhelming to say, okay, today I'm going to get up and I'm going to save the planet. That's a tough gig. And so mm-hmm. I really like the fact that you've outlined it as seven ways. And I would love for you to, just tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I know we don't want this to be all about the book, but I think that in terms of kind of my reflection on the experience and what, you know, what was the real impact on me from all of it too, you know, not thinking selfishly, but I wanted in a really meaningful way to be able to share the experience with everyone, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was encouraged to write a book and I'm like, you know, I don't want to write the astronaut memoir thing. Maybe I'll do a kid's book someday that's like, here's how Nicole became an astronaut. But I really, the power in it for me was not that. It was, man, what did I come back to Earth with? And it was really clear to me that somehow we've managed as this international community representing five international space agencies, 15 different countries, to come together on this machine that's orbiting our planet 16 times a day to work peacefully and successfully for this mission of off the Earth for the Earth, how everything we're doing there is ultimately about improving life on Earth. And I wanted to somehow summarize what are those ways, you know, that we're doing it. And it's everything from treating everything like it's local. You know, we live on a planet, but our planet is our neighborhood. It's not just the what extends in the 5 miles around me. Our mm-hmm. planet is our neighborhood. So global is local, right? And figuring out how to live that way. Understanding that there's a time for everything too. And we do have to react quickly to some things. They're urgent. And then there's other things that we just need to figure out what the pace is and acknowledge them. We need to be living in a way that we want to make everything better, make life better. We need to understand that having a connection with Earth, with our planet, I mean, really physically and emotionally, everything, having a connection to this place that's our home is vital to our own personal health, but to our planetary health as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like meditating, which might seem like a totally wacky thing to come out of, you know, technical spaceflight stuff. But I think it really is the human thing that we bring back to Earth. And how do we want to, impart that down here in a way that everyone can think, oh, well, I'll never be an astronaut. I can't ever understand that. When in fact, we're all on a spaceship.
Absolutely.
Here in space. And, you know, we all have a role. You know, I look in my backyard and I think about things like, man, I'm on the water. I don't want to use fertilizers on my grass that are going to leach off into the. So mm-hmm. I'm so thankful to live in a neighborhood where reclaimed water can be used, right?
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
But it's a choice I have to make. I could water with the city water if I wanted to and then fertilize and do all that. But there's these things available to us in our communities that we need to take advantage of. There's mm-hmm. choices we can make in our own kitchen. I mean, they seem like such almost little trivial things. Like, how can that in the grand scheme have any impact? But it is the power of us all bringing those little things together that mm-hmm. I think any big thing we look at has really started as some idea that seemed small mm-hmm. in the beginning and then just like blooms because of how wonderful and positively impactful it can be.
Yeah. I mean, just like space flight, right? At the end of the day, yeah. it was just a couple of people that decided to let's go for it and they managed. Yeah. And then now here you are. Absolutely.
Yeah. And yeah, it's, I wish everyone, and I think by speaking, like even like speaking to the kids, this the inspirational side of space exploration, which I think pretty much everybody is inspired by it in some way. And then, mm-hmm. I don't know, just opening our hearts and minds to what's possible. I mean, people would think that, you know, there was a time where the idea of launching into space and flying to the moon was not thought possible, except for by, mm-hmm. you know, sci-fi authors. And how we bring that sci-fi to sci-fact in a way that's good for all of us is by believing there's a solution to every challenging problem, right?
Definitely.
And in the space industry, you have a motto of here's how we can, not why we can't. And it's what brings those solutions to life, believing
yeah,
they can happen too.
I completely agree with you. And one of the sentences that I think should be banned, not to be like censorship, but one that I hate is when people say, oh, well, you know, it's not rocket science, implying that rocket science is the hardest thing on earth. And I'm like, guys, come on, like, we've done this. We do harder things than rocket science all the time. You probably do harder things than rocket science. Don't put a marker on this one, you know, feat of engineering that suddenly means that people are scared of it. And that really, really irks me. But yeah, but then on that path, I guess, you know, it's International Women's Day today, by the way, and happy International Women's Day. So taking a step back to, you know, before you got to space, you were obviously a NASA engineer for 20 years. And, you know, how did you get to that from, you know, a woman in engineering, woman in STEM? How did your, you know, it must not have been the most straightforward or the easiest path. And maybe it was for you. I know I'm an engineer myself and people ask me this question all the time. And I'm sorry, I'm asking you because it really annoys me actually. Being like, how did you get there? And I was like, well, I didn't really think I could do anything else. Like that was, it was just so obvious to me because of what my parents taught me. But I guess, yeah, how did you get there to be a NASA engineer? And how can people get there themselves?
You know, I feel the same way as what you just described. I'm hugely, ginormously thankful that I don't really have any memory of anyone along the way, at least overtly that I remember saying, oh no, Nicole, little Nikki, you can't do that because you have brown hair or you're a girl or what. My parents certainly didn't do that, which I'm so thankful for. It makes me so sad when I see that happening for kids. No one at school ever did. I was encouraged, which is what I think really helped lift me up and all of the things that I wanted to do. You know, flying was what inspired me. I think ultimately is like what got on this path. I wanted to fly myself. You know, I was thankful. I mean, that was introduced to me through my mom and my dad, you know, out at the local airport and the other flying people. And I mean, I'm old enough to have watched that first moon landing, right? And to have been inspired by that. No, I know. But I think even at 6 or 7, you realize that's an extraordinary thing to see happening. Even if you're not thinking at the time, oh, I need to do that. That's my thing. But these little steps along the way, just being introduced to things that I might or I might not be curious about, flying being one that I was, led me, you know, like opened up opportunities to meet people that I might not have met otherwise, to go study something at school that I might not have even known about when I was in high school. You know, I didn't know what engineering was when I was getting ready to graduate from high school, but oh my gosh, when I discovered, I'm like, oh, that's how you know how things fly? Okay, I'll do that. And then while I'm doing that, I'm like, oh my gosh, if I want to know how airplanes fly, why would I not want to know how rocket ships fly? And, but all along that, you know, when I look back in hindsight, I'm like, I was the only girl in my class. I was the only girl on my spaceflight cruise. But it didn't, I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about how excited I was to be doing this thing with other people around me that were excited about doing this. I certainly would have loved to have seen more women doing these things too. And I'm all about encouraging that happening now. But I think the bottom line is that there was something that inspired me. I was curious about it. I held on to that curiosity. And I just like figured out or was introduced to the things that allowed me to know more about that stuff. And I think that's what we need to be doing for young women and young men. We need to be encouraging them to pay attention to what they're curious about and then allowing them, making them welcome in whatever that is. And I think if we start worrying less about the numbers and more about the environment and the welcome, it's going to happen. It's going to come.
Yeah. But that's amazing. What a positive. Yeah. What a positive story as well. You know, I feel like those questions we're always expecting to hear something like, oh, and then I was told that this, and I went above and beyond to overcome these obstacles. And it was the same for me. You know, we weren't very, very many in my mechanical engineering class, but I didn't really know this. It's just kind of like you just do it because you love it. And then that's it really. And I completely echo what you say. You know, the best things you can tell kids, and we work with school children all the time, and it says just be curious and just be ambitious. You know, don't restrain your goals because you're scared of failing. And you know,
that's a big one. Example. That is a big one. And we can convince ourselves that somebody's going to tell us no before they ever do. Like we tell ourselves no.
Yeah.
before. I mean, ultimately for me, like with the astronaut thing, because that's always like the question, you know, in the end, well, if, you know, how'd you become the astronaut? I mean, I would have talked myself out of ever applying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would have discovered how much I really, you know, thought I could do a great job at that. But I would have second-guessed myself every step of the way. And not because anybody else told me I couldn't do it, but just because I had kind of this thing like, oh, that's something other special people get to do. Why would they ever pick mm-hmm. me? And, you know, all these things. And I am so thankful to the folks that I consider to be mentors who had taught me those, you know, there's solutions to every challenging problem, the here's how we can thing along the way. But they also just encouraged me to pick up the pen. They didn't mm-hmm. discourage me in any way. They didn't overblow it like, oh, you'll make the greatest astronaut there ever was. So I'd like to think they think that now. But they, you know, they just, it's like they gave me permission to do the one thing I had control of in that whole process. And that's what I think we need to be encouraging young people to do too. It's like, look for that thing. You know, there are going to be a lot of things that might hold you back or, you know, or that seem like are preventing you from something. But there's that one thing out there that you can do, and you've got to do it. Nobody else can do it for you.
Absolutely. You miss all the shots you don't take, the famous quote. But it's true.
You know, I always want to equate it to the you don't win if you don't pay with the lottery thing, but then I don't want to be encouraging people to play.
Yeah, yeah, let's go for sports.
You know, you don't win if you don't play. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so talking about NASA in general, then an interesting topic that I think is often discussed, especially in times where the economy is less good and things like that, you know, what is the role of space travel and organizations like NASA and obviously funding space travel and all these kind of things? Having lived it firsthand, what can you say is the role of those organizations and those programs in sustainability on Earth and the fight against climate change and inspiring people and all of that?
Yeah. Well, I'll start by just stepping back to our last conversation a little bit. You know, when I look at NASA and mm-hmm. my colleagues and I are always like, what is the secret sauce? I don't understand what it is. Because, you know, when you look over a 50-year period at just the diversity in NASA, the inclusive nature of the workplace, and that's of people and of thought, you know, it's of experience and color. It's of all of the mixes that we want to be bringing together to not just have a successful crew in space, you know, to do things, but to be solving really big problems, you know, here on Earth. And, you know, 50 years ago during Apollo, when that Earthrise thing was happening, there was one woman in the Mission Control Center in Houston. And she wasn't even in the front room. Poppy Northcutt, she was in the back room. There was one woman, Joanne Morgan, in the Launch Control Center. And long story short, now you look at the demographic of NASA, and I'm speaking to human spaceflight, both of those control centers, critical, vital to the implementation of everything we do, are run by really incredible women. And when you look in the control center, just this, like every flavor human you can imagine is in that place helping mm-hmm. make these things happen. So there's kind of a social, you know, example of, man, something that, there's got to be something right about what is going on at NASA for this kind of diversity to be in place there and to be encouraged and welcomed there.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's that piece of it. But, you know, from like the technical and all that side of it too, I think if anybody really looks into it, they will see that, and I say it all the time, everything we are doing in space in one way or another, from the technical side, from the international partnerships, from the, you know, the way we bring stuff, it's ultimately all about improving life on Earth. That's a fantastic thing to just start with, right? The motto of the space station is off the Earth for the Earth. So, and then you start digging down into the details of it. And we don't have to go into the money of it, but I will just tell you that in the grand scheme of things, trivial compared to, well, I just will for once, less than 20% is spent on NASA for each year for all of what NASA does, not just space stuff, aviation, everything else that NASA does too. Less than 20% each year is spent on that than is spent for one World Cup soccer tournament. So about $18 billion a year is spent on all of what NASA does. And that's tens of thousands of people across not just the US, but around the world that are employed in that venture. Mm-hmm. One World Cup costs $200 billion.
Yeah.
That's insane. To think that we can rationalize somehow across the public, or maybe ignorantly, that, and I got nothing against soccer tournaments, but that a sporting event, one sporting event, is worth, you know, 10 times what we invest in NASA each year.
Yeah, well.
I'll just leave it at that for the money stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe you know, and I'm sure you guys see that everywhere else too, you know, with other things. But that was like this, oh my gosh. Because I thought $18 billion was a lot of money. It's not. It's not even a line on the pie chart of what the United States spends on everything else as well. It would not run Health and Human Services for a day, right? Mm-hmm. So the return on investment is huge. And then when I look at it, and I think from a sustainability standpoint, first of all, you know, this idea of the space station being the best example of living off the grid you can find, all of that kind of tech and process that we do up there, we are bringing it back to Earth. Places on Earth that never had access to clean drinking water before have it now because of the technology we developed to provide clean drinking water in space. The way we're doing this right now, whether we think this is valuable or not, this ability to look each other on a screen and talk to each other, to connect this way, I think it is important. And it, and it's beyond just us doing a podcast like this. That connectivity is hugely significant to how we can distribute what we're learning in space that improves life on Earth. The way we measure the vital signs of our planet, every detail of what we need to know about how temperature is changing and water is rising and forests are being cleared and animals are being driven extinct, comes to us from space. And so you can tell I'm pretty passionate about this. I mean, I could go, you're probably like, she goes on for it with every question all day long.
It's great. It's
I could go all day about this, because I think it's kind of this hidden, mysterious thing about what's happening in space. And so it becomes really easy to trivialize it or to look at little things about it that seem in contrast to that. And so I really, really, I mean, one of my missions in life is for people to understand how space is, we're in space, but how everything we're doing off our planet is ultimately about improving life on it. And that's those billionaires too. You know, I just saw an article today about the woman who made the really wonderful donation to the medical school, $1 billion, so that students wouldn't, you know, have to pay for tuition to go earn their medical degrees there. It's fantastic, right? But then I see an article that then compares that to, you know, and then all these billionaires should be spending all of their money doing that kind of thing. And it trashed. I mean, it pointed out in particular the space-related billionaires. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Jeff Bezos, who is doing Blue Origin, which is a space company that, by the way, ultimately is looking at how do we lift all of the industrial nastiness off our planet into the benign environment of space in a sustainable way. Every year through Bezos Earth Fund commits $1 billion a year for at least $10 billion is committed through that fund to doing exactly what we're talking about today on this podcast, to very directly, very impactfully improving life on Earth. So I don't understand the argument about that kind of thing, you know?
I think people don't, and maybe that's a generation thing in clickbait titles and articles and maybe attention span. People like a catchy title and pointing fingers at the Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezos and everyone. And it's true, you know, they have so much money and so many resources. People will always have arguments as to how they should spend it. And we're not going to solve that right now. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting. And I can see that as well. You know, people do a good thing and instead of just focusing on the good thing, they manage to still turn it into a negativity towards other people. And it's just like, let's just praise the good things. And if everybody was always praising the good things and rewarding good behavior rather than pointing fingers all the time, I feel like more people would do rewarding things because then you get positive feedback.
Oh my gosh, moment. I so agree. You're like speaking to my heart. It's like, and I have a 21-year-old and it makes me so sad to think that the narrative is blame and guilt and negativity instead of looking at, there are some amazing, that's why I try to highlight in the book too. There are some amazing solutions happening right now
Absolutely.
You know, there are so many Earthlings or like crewmates that we already have on this planet that are trying to encourage everybody else to get out of passenger mode, right? And that can be done in a positive way. And, you know, even though these guys might not be the best at, you know, promoting the higher mission and what they're doing, it's happening. Go look at Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin website right now. The top line is for the benefit of Earth.
Mm.
I mean, that is their tagline. I don't think there's anything better than that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, mm-hmm. and then if you start looking at the work that's being done, that's in place there, it's all for the benefit of Earth. And that's mm-hmm. pretty amazing. And yet it doesn't get out there that way. And I think people are predisposed to think that billionaire equals bad. And I we've got to get out of that too, because that's not going to encourage them to want to.
No, exactly.
You know, you're bad. You've got to start, you know.
Yeah,
I want to be lifting. We need to be lifting each other up and working mm-hmm. towards the solution in a powerful, positive way. And that's, I don't think that's a naive comment. I don't think it's all. It's kumbaya. I think it's the reality of it. If we keep trying to push people down and burden them with the negativity, it's not gonna happen.
Yeah,
and that's not the path forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
So much good going on. My computer right now is propped up on the book by Paul Hawken, the drawdown drawdown book. I mean, there's magic right in there for everything we're talking about when it comes to sustainability. Simple solutions. And you're like, oh my gosh.
Get it out there.
So I'm so thankful to you, Gabrielle. Yeah.
No, definitely. So then coming back down to earth then and to finish off this podcast, what is your biggest mission now? So you've been to space, you were at NASA, you've written a book, you have a art foundation. What are you up to these days and where can people find you?
You can find me at my website, which is NicoleStott.com. And I also encourage you to check out the Space for Art Foundation at spaceforartfoundation.org. And my whole mission, everything I'm doing is about everything we just talked about today. I want people to understand not just what the space station is doing in space and how that's all about improving life on Earth. I want people to, like, in their daily lives, acknowledge and understand how things that we're doing off the planet are all about improving life on this planet and as well. And that's what the book is meant to be. That's what any speaking engagements I do. That's what this podcast for me is meant to be, and all the work that I do with kids around the world with, and my one colleague, Christina Korp, you know, she coined this term partners in purpose. And that's what I feel like the people I need to be engaging with need to have purpose. We need to be encouraging that purpose in them. And our kids, I think, are one of the best places for us to start. I mean, Space for Art Foundation is all about working with kids in places you hope are the worst place they'll ever have to experience in their life, right? You know, a pediatric cancer center, an orphanage, a refugee center, you know? And it became really clear to me that these kids get it. When you start talking to them about being crewmates and not passengers, they get it. They're already speaking to me about how what they go through in a hospital must be a lot like what, you know, somebody experiences as an astronaut, right? You know, see your friends and family the same way. You eat all different kinds of food. They're doing tests on you. There's radiation, all these things. I'm like, holy moly. And they get it. And we need to, and I think it's what we're really focused on. We need to make sure that they carry that forward in life with them and not have to be like me, where I rediscover that by having to by being in space and seeing my planet and like, oh my gosh, I live on a planet. They know that already. And so to encourage that kind of, get out of your bed in the morning, feet hit the floor, remind yourself you live on a planet in space, you're an earthling, that border, that blue that looks like it goes on forever is this veil, thin veil protecting us. And and just to accept that role as crewmates. And that connection between personal and planetary health, they love it. They understand it. And then they want to draw pictures about it and they want to see an art spacesuit with their art on it, you know, floating in space that tells that story as well. So
amazing. So inspiring. Yeah. Well, Earthlings listening, I hope we've converted a few passengers to crewmates. It's been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for doing this, Nicole. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Speak to you very soon.
Okay.